I was in San Francisco the other day, and an item in the San Francisco Chronicle caught my eye. It was about a woman who had earned a fortune designing and selling clothes for the children of the well-to-do. It said her secret was in the simplicity of the clothes she produced. The story carried a headline that read, "Children's Styles That Last Forever." The article, written by Joan Chatfield Taylor, began, "It's often true that the simplest things cost the most money, and nowhere is it truer than in children's clothes. If it's ruffles, bows, trendy colors, and faddy styles you want for your little darling, you can just stroll down to your five-and-dime mail-order catalog or discount store. If it's an absolutely plain dress or play suit you want, you may have to go to the seventh floor of iMagnon to buy a Florence Eisman." Florence Eisman has been called the Norell of the children's wear industry. Like Norell, she specializes in rather simple shapes, perfectly executed in the best available fabrics. Also like Norell, she makes clothes that don't go out of date. The clothes she designed in the 50s could be worn by children today. Florence Eisman believes in utterly simple dresses, preferably without belts or waistlines, in clear bright colors or classic neutrals like gray, navy, and black. The declining birth rate has been hard on the children's wear industry, but Florence Eisman continues to thrive. The high quality of the fabrics, most of which are imported from Europe, and the workmanship, all of which is done at the Eisman factories in Milwaukee and Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, are two reasons for the durability of Eisman designs. Well, in reading that story, I was struck by how much we can learn from it. It's a story that has to be told and learned over and over again. First, simplicity of design. Design following function. What is the product supposed to do? It's supposed to clothe small children who must not only look good in their clothes, but who spend a good deal of their time running, playing, squirming, climbing, sliding, staining, straining, and subjecting to every torture test possible the clothes they wear. Children don't change. They are much the same today as they were 10,000 years ago. Secondly, quality of materials and workmanship. Incidentally, I mentioned that I wanted to use the Florence Eisman story for direct line to my wife, and she informed me that our little boy, Ted, wore nothing but Florence Eisman clothes when he was small, and that the clothes are still in service with various relatives. As I read the Florence Eisman story, it reminded me of a Sidney J. Harris column I had read in Clip the week before. Mr. Harris had predicted in a column written nearly 30 years before that the men's hat industry would very likely come to an end during his lifetime. After the column appeared, he'd received a stiff letter from the president of the Stetson Company taking issue with him and telling him he didn't know what he was talking or writing about. Well, last year, the Stetson Company went out of business. A few months later, HCA, the largest volume hat maker in the United States, announced that it intended to sell out. Sid Harris went on to point out that today about one man in 30 buys a hat, while at the turn of the century almost every man did. And he said, "I have long maintained that the so-called practical businessmen often don't know their own business, and that social theorists, poets, and even vagrants could sometimes tell them more about what's happening or going to happen than they learn from interviewing one another in the 537 club car back to the Ivory Suburb." In his column, written back in 1944, Sid Harris suggested that the American male was seeking a new masculine image, and that the traditional hat foisted on him since Victorian times made him feel foolish, pompous, and inept. I and all my friends under 30 at the time wouldn't be caught dead in a hat. But the hatmakers blindly persisted in relying on classical styles when the whole mood and tempo of life had shifted into a higher gear. It was not lack of funds or facilities, as much as lack of imagination, that presaged the doom of the conventional American hat. Beginning after World War II, the American man resented the bland uniformity of the dumb-looking hat, which not only failed to make him look dashing and virile, in the past his father wanted only to look respectable, but also blew off in the slightest wind, failed to provide warmth and comfort, and became permanently misshapen in the first rainstorm. Florence Eisman waxed prosperous in the world's most competitive business, while the giants in the men's hat business, with all the wealth and facilities at their beck and call, failed. Florence Eisman makes simple, well-designed children's clothes that appeal to the good taste of discriminating adults and the functional needs of children, fashioned from the finest materials and sturdily fabricated to take such punishment for many years. The men's hat industry, on the other hand, it seems to me, did not ask, how can we design hats to fit the needs and desires of a changing market? Instead, they tried to sell a changing market an unchanging product. I think the American automakers missed the boat on the small, inexpensive-to-buy-and-operate car for the same reasons. The hat makers blindly persisted in relying on classical styles when the whole mood and tempo of life had shifted into a higher gear. I think that What Sidney Harris wrote about the hat business in 1944 is true of the world automotive market today, in which there's been a very obvious change going on for some time. I think many of the products turned out by the major automakers are as obsolete today as the Victorian hat. And I think the first one that applies the common sense, good taste system of Florence Eisman will capture an inordinate share of not just the American market, but the world auto market as well. Now, how about what we do? How can we apply the Florence Eisman formula to what we produce? It isn't her formula at all, really, as I'm sure she'd be the first to admit. It goes all the way back to ancient Greece. She and the few others like her have simply had the good judgment and good taste to apply the formula and reap the inevitable rewards. It will perhaps pay us to take a new look at what we do and ask some important questions, such as, 1, what is my product or service supposed to do? What is its real function? 2, is it doing that in the best and most direct way possible? 3, is it simple, uncluttered, in good taste, and of the best materials available to me? 4, does it meet the needs of my customers and prospects, and will it continue to meet their needs for many years to come? 5, is it the very best we can produce to do the job it is intended to do? 6, do we have our customers' best interest in first place, or have we made them subordinate to profits? The test of a good or great product is that it tends to remain in style for many years, even centuries. The architecture, statuary, and literature of ancient Greece is still right up to date, as interesting and as valuable today as it was 2,000 years ago. A Stradivarius violin or a painting by one of the masters, good crystal, silver, and china, all have appreciated over the years, like good real estate. Now, how about what we do? Will it meet the test of greatness, or be so much useless junk in a few short years? I know a man and his wife who migrated from a small town in Oklahoma to the big city of Los Angeles. When his friends asked them what they were going to do out there, they told him that they were going to stay in the same business, which was operating a medium-sized eating place. Nothing fancy, just hamburgers, fried chicken and shrimp, soft drinks and coffee. Well, as friends do, they shook their heads and did their best to dissuade them. They told my friends that there were almost as many eating places in Los Angeles as there are people. One report even says that there's more. Why, on just one boulevard, you know, the one that's hard to pronounce, there are 1,000 eating places lined up on both sides of the street so close together they breathe on each other with their exhaust fans. But undaunted, the couple moved to the great sprawling city with its teeming millions of people and ubiquitous eating places. In an undistinguished part of town, on an undistinguished thoroughfare, they rented a very small vacant store. They equipped it with the necessities for such a place, with only 4 or 5 rough tables and benches, put a small identifying sign out front, and opened for business. Within 60 days, they were operating a gold mine. They had planned to be open 7 days a week until they found which day was the lightest, and then they'd close on that day. There were no light days. Every day was busy, and the little cash register rang from morning to night. They were so busy cooking hamburgers, they didn't have time to clean off the tables. So the customers did it for them, putting the paper cups and plates and napkins into the trash can for them. They then hired a boy to keep the place clean and generally help around the place. Every night, they'd go home exhausted but happy. Their business is a big success. Right across the street from them, a large, nationally syndicated and advertised drive-in has been in operation for several years. Soon, the manager of that place was sneaking into my friend's place to eat his lunch, and his employees dropped in after their shifts. Working people from as far as 10 miles away drive to my friend's place for hamburgers. A couple from a little town in Oklahoma have become a hit in the big city with the thousands of eating places. How did they do it? Charge less for their hamburgers? No, theirs actually cost more than the average. But instead of competing with all the other eating places in the city, my friends created. Instead of buying the uniform little hamburger patties from the wholesaler, as most everybody else does, so that every hamburger tastes exactly alike, no matter where you go. My friends buy their hamburger from a local supermarket and make their own, 4 to the pound. Each hamburger has 1/4 pound of meat, is served on a 5-inch toasted bun with crisp, fresh lettuce, garden-grown tomatoes, and thick, juicy slices of onion. Their secret? It's simple. They just serve the best hamburgers anybody ever ate. They'll never sell as many as the big place across the street, maybe, but they sell all they can cook. And the little cash register rings all day long. Will Durant, the famous philosopher, has written that human beings can be divided into two main categories, negative and positive. Now, we all know there are people who have more positive impulses than negative impulses. With these positive people, the tendency is to approach, to seek, to overcome, and to possess. These are the positive characteristics. And there are others in whom the negative impulses predominate, people in whom the tendency generally is to hesitate, to retreat, to find shelter and safety, to submit. And it's these people the philosophers call the negative characters. Now, no person is entirely all of one or the other. Each of us has some of both, but we lean heavily toward one or the other. Dr. Will Durant says the negative character tends to be undersized, and though he admires very much every redeeming quality of his face, his form, his mind, he's always awkwardly conscious of his physical inferiority and looks enviously out of the corner of his eye at the tall and vigorous workman or the man of affairs who passes by erect in the pride of stature and health. What the negative person lacks above all is body, energy, horsepower, according to Durant. He seems not to have enough blood. At the table, he has no appetite. He's finicky with food and easily disgusted. He worries about whether he left a big enough tip. He walks from the room as if he hoped no one would see him and feels as though everyone is looking at him. If insult or danger comes, he trembles with surprise and fear. He does not feel active anger, but is consumed with a fretful resentment. His violence is the mask of one who knows that he will submit. He shrinks from responsibility and trial and longs for the quiet security and retreat of his home. He admires the cowboy and the Superman. He believes that the world would trust him with leadership if it had intelligence. If he succeeds in anything, he credits himself. If he fails, he's not guilty, according to him. He blames the environment or the stars. He never blames himself for failure, but gets bitter toward the world instead. Nevertheless, he may be great by the very force of that unrestrained imagination that always seems to go along with negative characters. At his height, he may become a poetic genius. At his lowest, he is an intellectual, not a thinker. He never walks if he can ride. He never stands when he can sit. And he never stays awake when he can sleep. Because of this, he cannot sleep well. He hasn't been awake enough to bring on restful sleep. His nerves are tired, but his flesh is not. He's always on edge. He is social in his hunger for popular approval. He conforms timidly to the conventions. Withal, he is kindly and affectionate, grateful, loyal, and reverent. There is no cruelty in him and little coarseness. He is restless, though always seeking rest. He passes discontent from project to project and from place to place. He is a ship that never makes a port while its cargo rots. He is given to bursts of passion that simulate strength, but they end in quick exhaustion and accepted chaos. He has 1,000 wishes, but no will. Will Durant's bleak description of the negative character. Now, here's his description of the positive character. The positive person has health and vigor, a sufficiency of flesh and blood to warrant him looking straight into the eyes of the world and wearing his hat as he likes. If he looks at you, it's face to face. But he does not look at you. He is absorbed in his enterprise, intent on his goal. He is less interested in persons than in purposes. All the impulses of approach are strong in him. He eats with gusto. He has a passion for acquisition and possession. His motto is to have and to hold. And because he's more self-assertive and successful than a negative man, he makes every modern nation into a replica of himself, rapaciously acquisitive. Or maybe he has an extravagant wife. In olden days, he would have been a feudal baron or a soldier. But today, he's an executive, and just as positive as when he brandished a javelin. In him, desires are not timid aspirations. They're unavoidable impulsions. For their sake, he will accept responsibilities, dangers, and wearing toil. He has more courage than virtue and less conscience than pride. He has powerful ambitions. He despises limits and suspects humility. If he meets a man stronger or firmer than himself, his impulse is not to bow down before him, but to honor him with emulation and rivalry. If he is defeated, it is after a struggle to exhaustion. He is curious. All processes lure him, and his mind plays actively about strange and novel things. He believes in action rather than in thought, and like Caesar, he thinks nothing finished if anything remains undone. He likes a tumultuous life and is not tempted by rural simplicity and peace. Peace, he thinks, was made for old age and does not become a man. He is domineering and likes to feel that men are bricks to his trowel to build with them what he likes, and they find a secret zest in being led by him. He's so certain, so confident, and so cheerful. His activity makes him healthy and leaves him no time for thought or gloom. He enjoys life, bad as it might be, and does not ponder much on the future or the past. Nevertheless, he's a man of ideas, not a poet, nor a painter, nor a theoretical philosopher, nor a scientist, but an inventor, an architect capable of original designs, an engineer brave enough to span great rivers with poems of woven steel, a sculptor commanding marble into life, a scientist willing to face all the world in defense of a new truth. When his wife irritates him, he goes to his club. When the club bores him, he forgets himself and his work. His active life defends him against nerves. What he has above all is will. Not wills, but will. Not a medley of ambitions and desires canceling one another in unreconciled hostility, but a unity of aim, an order, and perspective of purpose. He dies never doubting that life was a boon, and only sorry that he must leave that game to younger players. Each of us has some of the positive and some of the negative in our makeup. The idea is try to make the best use of the good qualities of both. Here's some information about an unlooked-for but exciting development. We're not just having a population explosion in the world, but here in America and in other Western countries, we're having an explosion of geniuses. And it makes for an interesting future, an acceleration of the times, which are already stunning in the fields of science. Time magazine reported some time back that one of the delights of co-education and rising college entrance standards is that the smartest 10% of young Americans are now thrown together on campuses at the most susceptible age for romance and marriage. The genetic consequence, reports physicist John R. Platt in the University of Chicago magazine Context, is a zooming output of high IQ children. These marriages are now producing 5 or 10 times the total number of youngsters with IQs of 150, for example, that we would get from perfectly random marriages in the normal population, where IQs average 100. He says that even more spectacular children may be coming out of the intellectual colonies like Oak Ridge or Los Alamos, where one man in six has a PhD, and out of the faculty communities of the great universities, where all the men and many of the women have advanced degrees. In the schools of such centers, says Platt, whole classes of 130s and 140 IQs may be seen from kindergarten through high school. Among the results can be found a 13-year-old studying atomic physics seriously, an 11-year-old doing graduate work in mathematics. In the general population, only one person in 300 reaches the 140 level. But if whole communities reach an average of 140, asks Platt, does one child in 300 reach an IQ of 180, and one in 2,000 reach 190? If this turns out to be so, we may not have to wait centuries for the next Newton. We may have a dozen within 20 years. The number of 180s getting out of college in the next few years may not be a mere dozen, but hundreds. It could be an explosion of genius such as the world has never seen. It's an exciting idea, isn't it? You know, science and the arts don't move ahead steadily. They don't progress automatically, linearly. They move ahead in spurts, as here one person and there another makes a breakthrough. It's always a single individual, never the group, that makes an important discovery or improvement of an old principle. But they seem to come in batches. And with so many brilliant young people coming into the fields of science and industry and government, we can look for a definite surge in creativity in the solving of old problems. This will be reflected in every facet of our world, from furniture to automotive design, in education, the arts, space technology, medicine and manufacture, distribution and sales of products, and the improvement of services. And this great new crop of geniuses will produce still more, of course. As physicist John Platt says, it could be an explosion of genius such as the world has never seen. A doctor was doing some generalizing one day, and he said, people have headaches generally because they don't avoid them. And a man named Kenneth Good says that people lose mostly because they won't take the trouble to win. It's all based on the answer one man got when he asked a friend of his, how many people work down where you're employed? And his friend answered, oh, about half. It seems that, except under the stress of a lot of emotion, fear of failure, heat of competition, or contest promoted to stimulate artificially these emotions, most people, including top business executives and men in the professions, rarely make any appreciable effort to improve their daily working methods beyond the minimum necessary to overcome each new emergency. This is according to Professor E. Lewis Swift of Washington University. The Chicago Sales Marketing Executives Club made an analysis some years back that proved that more than twice as many salesmen are fired for lack of effort than they are for illness, dishonesty, drinking, and gambling combined. And as for the rest of the people, An expert on scientific management, Mr. Frederick W. Taylor, proved that men and women are perfectly content to coast along on methods several times short of their best. According to Dr. William James, the wise old Harvard professor called the father of American psychology, compared with what we ought to be, we're only half awake. Powers of various sorts we habitually fail to use. And Walter Dill Scott of Northwestern University said, many of us never know our possible achievements because we've never warmed up. It is more than probable that the average man could, with no injury to his health, increase his efficiency 50%. Which all goes to prove that the human race is fixed. Not to prevent the strong from winning, far from it, but fixed to prevent the rest from losing. It's a fact that to get ahead in the world these days, an average person needs neither the industry of Edison, nor the ambition of Napoleon, or the cunning of Machiavelli, or the wiles of Lucretia Borgia. Just the opposite is true. Any man or woman going seriously to work, just seriously, mind you, will, as a rule, encounter unbelievably little opposition. He will, in fact, find his fellow citizens slowed way down for his benefit. Because most people work half-heartedly, using only a fraction of their potential powers, putting a man or woman with even a little ambition and a serious attitude toward his or her future into this group is like dropping a greyhound into a race of snails. And it's believed that the majority does not take a serious attitude toward the future because the majority fails to decide upon one. Not knowing where they're going, they have no reason to hurry. It's easier to win than to lose. Easier to succeed than to worry. The reason most choose the latter is because they can be done sitting down. We have more mental infirmities than all other illnesses combined. Dr. Charles H. Mayo once said that half the beds in our hospitals are filled by those people who worried themselves into them. You know, the mind is like an adding machine. Before you can solve a problem with it, it must be cleared of all previous problems. Worry jams up the mechanism. It short circuits the whole operation, and the most valuable mechanism on earth just sits there and hums, feeding upon itself. It can't possibly solve your problems until it's been cleared, until worry has been cleared away. It's been proved many times that by a simple change in attitude, in mental outlook, that the same amount of time and energy devoted to worry could be used to solve our problems. Instead of worrying about the bills that have to be paid, shift gears and think creatively about ways of making more money. Instead of constantly stewing and worrying about a problem, we should try to think of ways of solving it. Creative people look at problems as challenges. They realize that without problems, everything would come to a stop. Problems are what keep the race moving forward. They're responsible for every forward step we've ever taken, collectively or individually. All industry exists solely for the solving of our problems, as does agriculture, education, and government. A person goes to school to learn to solve his problems and the problems of others. Where would the doctors be if there were no health problems, or dentists, or lawyers, or businessmen, or teachers, or workers? A woman wants to change the color scheme of her bedroom, and a painter gets a day's work. A paint company sells some paint, and so on. We've all got problems, and that's good. Without them, we'd still be swinging through the trees and living in caves, and all problems are temporary. As the wise man said, this too shall pass. So if you want to have a lot more fun and a lot less worry, try to put your problems in their true perspective. See yourself as a part of the world, and the world as a part of the universe, and the universe as a part of a great and mysterious living picture. Seen in their true light, most problems shrink to their true size. Then, don't worry about it. Shift your mental gears. Clear your mind of worry and set your mind to the solution of the problem. It has a solution. It will be solved. The same kind of problem has been solved a million times before. But as a wise old man said to me one time, in a life where death is inevitable, never worry about anything. If you come across a plank on the ground, say the plank is 12 feet long and 12 inches wide, you'd have no trouble walking from one end of it to the other. Now let's put that plank 100 feet high and stretch it between two buildings with nothing under it except 100 feet of air and a street down below. Would you walk it now? Same plank, same distance, but a different, more demanding situation. Let's say you're telling your family gathered around the dinner table about something in which you believe, your philosophy of living, for example. Now change the setting to an auditorium with 1,000 people in the audience, with you standing on stage before the podium. You're saying the same thing in the same way, but the setting's changed. Walking the plank and making the talk are easy for you in one set of circumstances. Without changing your performance at all, but only the setting, a new element is introduced which changes your mental attitude considerably. fear of what might happen under this new set of circumstances turns two perfectly simple and natural performances into occasions of great risk. So great that you might refuse to do either of them. Not the fear of what will happen, but the fear of what might happen. Now, since you know perfectly well that you can walk the plank if it's on the ground, it stands to reason you can walk the same plank anyplace else. If you can make a talk under one set of circumstances, you can make the same talk under any other conditions. Anyone can see how true this is. But, and it's that but that seems to keep us from taking a formula we know will work under one condition and applying it to a larger situation. The fear of what might happen holds us back. We permit ourselves to fail by default, rather than run the risk of failing as a result of having made the effort to succeed. Now, it's not important that we walk the length of a plank, whether it's on the ground or high in the air, and it's not too important whether we make our little talk to the people in the auditorium, perhaps. But how many things are there at which we succeed, at which we could be successful on a much larger scale? It's all a mental game. We play the whole thing out in our minds, and it's there, not in actual practice, that we win or lose. No one can even guess how much is lost by the so-called average person simply because he fears to make the attempt. His fear of failure in his own eyes, in the eyes of his family and friends, and the possible loss of a small stake, raise a formidable wall between his reality and his dream. So he contents himself to peek at his dream over the top of the wall and wait. Wait until conditions are better, until Uncle Charlie dies and leaves all that money. But waiting just seems to make the wall grow higher. Conditions seem to remain about the same, and Uncle Charlie's going to outlive everybody in the family. And finally, even on tiptoes, you can't see over the wall anymore. It's too high now, and it's too late. Well, so what? It was just an idea, a dream. Yes, that's all it was, just an idea, a dream. But what could it have been? What might it have been if you'd scrambled over that wall before it got too high? Bertrand Russell wrote, "Our instinctive emotions are those that we have inherited from a much more dangerous world and contain, therefore, a larger portion of fear than they should."